Before we delve into today's topic, let me just fill you in on the sort of background to this particular series of talks that we're starting today. Before Christmas, I put a question on Facebook. I said, friends who aren't Christians, can you complete this following sentence? I could never be a Christian because... And this sermon series, we're looking at different answers that some of my friends gave to that question. So this week we're looking at atheism. Next week we're looking at questions about morality. Then after that, how do we respond when people say Christians are hypocrites? And then finally, thinking a little bit about those who say they believe in science instead. And I dare say there might be some people here who resonate with some of those questions, maybe particularly with that first one. Maybe you've got doubts about whether God actually exists or not. It's a pretty fundamental question to Christian faith. But even if you don't have that sort of question in your mind, I hope that you'll find this series helpful as you chat with family or friends who have got those sorts of questions, because I'm sure we've all got family and friends who have these sorts of issues. And so maybe, try out some of what we say on them, or sit down with them over a coffee or a pint and listen online afterwards to the sermon or have a discussion with them, and use this as a launch pad for some deeper conversations. Of course, I don't pretend I've got the final answer on any of these topics, but each week I'll try to bring along some of the books or articles that I found helpful. I'll make links to them on the e-letter that goes out each week if you've signed up for that, if you want to take these things a little bit further. Let's turn to today's topic. And one friend of mine finished that sentence, I could never be a Christian because, by saying, I just don't believe in a God. Another said, I don't like organized religion and there are no gods. Another said, as much as I wish I could, I just don't feel that he exists. Maybe you remember the famous Buzz advert from 10 years ago. There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. And that was Richard Dawkins and the Humanist Association encouraging people to get on board with the idea that there is no God. One poll a few years ago said or found out that about 14% of the UK describe themselves as convinced atheists. And of course there'll be many more who aren't sure, who are agnostics. So how would I answer friends who say that to me? Well, one thing I wouldn't do is give a 20-minute monologue, which of course is what I'm about to do now, but I'd try to open up the debate with questions. And when Jesus was questioned by people about what he was teaching, he often responded with questions in return. And the more we understand where people are coming from, the better the discussion is going to be and the more fruitful. So I'd ask as maybe an introductory question, well, why don't you believe in a God? And that sort of question allows people to explain their reasoning, where they're coming from. And in my experience, some people will respond, well, actually, how could I believe in a God when there's so much suffering in the world? Now, the question of suffering is a really important and valid question, but just because there is suffering in the world doesn't mean that there is no God. Or other people might respond, well, I don't believe in God because I had a really bad experience of Christianity when I was growing up. Or I don't believe in God because of science. And so can you see how that opening question just will take the conversation in different sorts of directions depending on why people don't believe in God? Maybe another introductory question would be, what sort of God don't you believe in? And very often people will describe a caricature of the Christian God. And you know what a caricature is? It sort of exaggerates some features and it diminishes other features. And so often we'll be able to respond, actually, you know what? I don't believe in that sort of God either. I don't believe in a God who's unjust or homophobic or anti-intellectual or unloving or whatever their particular notion of God is. And establishing that as a sort of common fundamental is a good place on which we can build conversation. But what if those introductory sorts of questions then reveal that the issue is quite an intellectual opposition to the notion that there is a God? Well, I'd still want to probe. You know, as Christians, we don't have to be on the back foot all the time. Yes, as Christians, there are some things which, challenges which we have to answer because we believe in God, such as, the existence of suffering. But for those who don't believe in a God, there's questions which they need to answer as well. And it's all right to challenge people about those sorts of issues. Here are some of the, or I'll try to explain some of the issues which I think atheists need to have a good answer to. But before I get there, let's be honest. There's actually very few things in life that you can prove categorically. You can't prove that love exists. You can't prove that the sun will rise tomorrow. You can't prove that you're the same person that you were 10 years ago. And I can't prove that God exists. The atheist can't prove that God doesn't exist. But what we can do is look at the evidence and see where the evidence leads us. So as a Christian, I believe that the evidence leads in the direction of actually believing in God is a rational thing to do. And the atheist will say, well, looking at the evidence, my interpretation of the evidence, I think that not believing in God is a rational thing to do. But either way, in effect, they are faith positions. They are faith positions. So here's some of the issues that the atheists need to be able to answer. How do you explain something from nothing? How do you explain something from nothing? You see, 100 years ago, most people believed that the universe had always existed. Einstein believed that. And now scientists are pretty unanimous that the universe hasn't always existed. There was a Big Bang. And that since then, the universe has been constantly expanding. That's what the evidence points to. So 15 billion years ago, nothing. 14 billion years ago, nothing. 13.7 billion years ago, something. A big explosion takes place and the universe comes out of it. But how do we get something from nothing? You know, that doesn't make sense to me. What caused the Big Bang? You know, if you believe in some God, then it's easy to say that God caused the Big Bang. But if you don't believe in a God, how can something appear out of nothing? Scientists find that a really hard question to answer. Even Darwin, at the beginning of The Origin of the Species, acknowledged God as the source. One person put it like this: you can choose between the virgin birth of Christ or the virgin birth of the cosmos, but you have to choose your miracle. Which is it to be? You see, I find it more logical to believe that something came from someone, God, rather than that something came from nothing. Here's a second question for the atheist. How do you explain order from chaos? How do you explain order from chaos? You see, normally explosions leave carnage. Some of you will remember a few years ago, a house blew up in a gas explosion down on the estate. Mercifully, no one was seriously injured. But, you know, it leaves carnage. You don't get order from the chaos of an explosion. So how does the atheist explain that the Big Bang explosion leaves a highly ordered world? A world with atoms and molecules and galaxies. A world with mind-bogglingly intricate DNA coding in every single cell, amoeba even. Surely that's like a house exploding and finding that, you know, when the dust settles, we've got a nice pile, tidy pile of bricks over here, and we've got all the slate over here, and we've got all the furniture has landed up over here. You know, that just doesn't happen, does it? Order doesn't come from chaos. Scientists have identified 15 numbers or constants that the universe relies on to exist. And if any one of those was off slightly, then the universe couldn't survive in its form. It's called the fine tuning of the universe, but it's not the sort of fine tuning that a guitarist does when they're tuning up ready for a church service. It's infinitely more intricate than that. For example, if the ratio between the strong nuclear constant and the electromagnetic constant was different by one part in 10 million billion, there wouldn't be any stars. And then there are 14 other constants a bit like that, which are just as critical to the universe's existence. What are the chances of that happening? Paul Davies, the distinguished physicist from New Zealand, says it's the same chance as aiming at a target an inch wide on the other side of the observable universe, 20,000 million light years away, and hitting the target. What are the chances of order from chaos? Now, if there is a God, it's no problem to believe that God designed the universe like this. As Fred Hoyle, the man who coined the term the Big Bang and who used to be an atheist, he put it like this. He said, "It looks as if a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology." Now, some scientists will respond to that and talk about a multiverse theory. The idea that there have been billions of other Big Bangs over the years, which have all resulted in effect in nothing, and we just happen to be in the one which has come to something and survived. But that is pure theory. There's no evidence for that. So we're left with two alternatives. Either there are billions of other universes we can't see and have no evidence for, or there's a creator that we can't see. Even diehard atheists will admit it boils down to those two sorts of options. And as one writer put it, I find it easier to believe in one unseen, unprovable entity than in billions of unseen, unprovable entities. Here's another question for the atheist. How do you explain life from matter? How can you explain life from matter? You see, it's one thing to say that the Big Bang results in rocks flying through space, but how does inorganic matter, rocks, somehow become life? Salmon and snowdrops and sparrows. Many scientists believe in evolution, of course, but that doesn't answer how life came to exist. It simply explains how complex life came from simple life. Of course, if there is a God, it's easy to say that God deliberately created life. But if there is no God, there's a much harder job to explain how life emerges from matter. So the medical student can analyze her boyfriend into, you know, water and calcium and fat and whatever else. But that's not why they like the boyfriend, is it? You know, they've got personality, they've got character, they're alive. What is it that makes that? So Paul Davis, again, who's not a Christian, by the way, he says, the physical species Homo sapiens is no minor byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces. We are truly meant to be here. The physical universe is put together with an ingenuity so astonishing that I cannot accept it merely as brute fact. There must be a deeper level of explanation. But even if you can explain life from matter, then how do you explain something as complex as humanity from simple life forms? You know, human beings we're aware that we exist. That is a very complex nature of life. We're able to produce music and art and appreciate beauty and sunsets and so on. How do you explain how humans have a conscience which tells us right from wrong? How do you explain why we value truth if there is no ultimate reality? How do you explain why we value goodness if essentially we're all derived from plankton? How do you explain something as complex as humanity emerging from something so simple? And as a Christian, believing in a personal God, each of those things is very easy to explain. You know, that he is a God of truth explains why we value truth. That he is a creative God explains why we're able to be creative and appreciate creativeness. That he is a just God explains why we have a conscience. And looking at this sort of evidence, I think it actually takes more faith to believe that there is no God than it takes to believe that there is a God. Put all of that sort of stuff together, I think it takes more faith to believe there isn't a God than that there is a God. Even Jean-Paul Sartre, the atheist, who consistently maintained that God is dead, and man like a crumpled little piece of paper in the rain whose only liberation is death, he began to see things differently at the end of his life. He said, I don't see myself as so much dust that has appeared in the world, but as a being that was expected, prefigured, called forth. In short, a being that could, it seems, only come from a creator. And this recognition of a creative hand drives me back to God. So you see, I think there's good scientific grounds for believing in God. I think there's good philosophical grounds for believing in God. But we can't really know what that God is like unless that God chooses to make themselves known. And that, of course, is the Christian claim of exactly what has happened as Jesus of Nazareth was born onto this earth and walked around. And so here's the final question I'd want to put to atheists. How do you explain Jesus? How do you explain the Jesus phenomenon? You see, no historian doubts that Jesus actually existed and that he had a relatively brief but very popular ministry, which was characterized by amazing miracles and astounding teaching. And very few historians would doubt that he was brutally executed. But you see, normally such a brutal execution of a religious leader who'd only been around for a few years puts pay to any followers managing to maintain or develop that movement for long. Most other religious movements of Jesus' day died out after just a few years. And so what was it after Jesus' death which enabled that ragtag band of Jesus' dejected, downhearted followers to endure yet more public executions and become so well known, a force for good, that they were known throughout the universe within throughout the empire within a generation, and then they'd transformed that empire within a few hundred years? How do you explain the Jesus phenomenon? And historians would say there must have been some utterly remarkable event to make that sort of turnaround. An event as remarkable maybe as their leader coming back from the dead? Well, it sounds fanciful, doesn't it? But look at the evidence. Look at the evidence. And I love that story of Thomas that we heard read a few minutes ago, who, like all of Jesus' friends, Thomas was so crushed by Jesus being executed. And when his friends started saying a few days later, look, we've seen Jesus alive again. And Thomas is there thinking, oh, get real, please. You know, this is just delusions, hallucinations of people who are in grief and shock. No, I'm not going to believe that Jesus has risen again unless I can put my finger in the nail marks on his hands and put my hand in the side where the spear went. I want evidence. And of course, a week later, that's exactly the evidence he gets. They're in a locked room and Jesus appears and he says to Thomas, look, Thomas, stop doubting, believe, put your finger in the nail marks, put your hand in my side. It is me. And Thomas, confronted with that sort of evidence, reaches his conclusion and he says, my Lord and my God. And he was so convinced by what he saw that day and over subsequent weeks that he gave the rest of his life to traveling and telling people about Jesus. Eventually, he was killed for his faith over in India, preaching about Jesus being God in human flesh, preaching about how Jesus shows us the wonderful character of God, this God who is loving and merciful and powerful and personal and compassionate and holy and just and so on. This God who reaches out to us and wants this friendship with us, so much so that he comes to earth and he even dies for us. So I can't prove that there is a God, but I think there's really good evidence that points in that sort of conclusion. I can't prove that Jesus is that God, but I think there's really good evidence to say that he is. And so, like Thomas, I address Jesus as my Lord and my God. And I'd urge you to do the same. I don't know where you stand in terms of spiritual things and what you believe about God, what you believe about Jesus. Come on that Jesus the Game Changer course if you want to find out more about Jesus. We'd love to chat these things through with you. You don't have to leave your brains at the door to be a Christian. There is good evidence. Those are some of the questions I would want to ask an atheist. But I want to finish this morning by a question for the person who does believe in Jesus. I came across this quote from John Stott this week. The invisibility of God is a great problem. It was already a problem to God's people in Old Testament days. Their pagan neighbors had gods who were visible and tangible, but Israel's God was neither. Their neighbors would taunt them, saying, "Where is your God?" How then has God solved the problem of his own invisibility? The first answer, of course, is in Christ. John 1 verse 18, no one has ever seen God, but God the only Son has made him known. But is there no way by which the invisible God makes himself visible today? There is. 1 John 4 verse 12, no one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us. In other words, the invisible God who once made himself visible in Christ now makes himself visible in Christians if we love one another. I find those challenging words. You know, friends, intellectual arguments alone are never going to convince someone to become a Christian. But love will. What's the best way to demonstrate the existence of God? It's to show God's love at work in our lives. To let God's love so fill us and transform us that we love one another in the way that he loved us, sacrificially. To so love our friends and neighbours and colleagues who don't yet believe in God, not to sort of try to love bomb them into the kingdom as if that would be possible, but to demonstrate that overwhelming love of God which has transformed us and which spills over to the lives of those around us. So the question for the believer is simply this: if we want people to believe in God, will we love them as Jesus has loved us? It's a challenging question.